Let's see how this goes. So we are in Shoftim Perek Yud Aleph, chapter 11, and specifically we're up to Pasuk Yud Dalet. Because we didn't meet last week, thanks to Purim, I'll just do a very quick recap of where we've been with Yiftach. You will recall that he starts out as an outcast. He is the son of an Isha Zonah. We gave different explanations for what that can mean. His brothers are not interested in having him around. We noted that they seem to be the younger brothers. And they kick him out. We did have the idea of the Chida, that he's a person of exceptionally fine character. He doesn't want to fight, and therefore he moves out himself. Either way, he moves to Eretz Tov. And then the Jews get in trouble because Amon is threatening, and they say, well, let's go get Yiftach, and they make Yiftach an offer. And that was in Pasuk Vav. And we noted that it's actually, there seems to be a series of offers that are involved, as Malbim explained it. They want him to be a katzin, which is a leading warrior, but not to be in charge. That's the initial offer that they make. And then there's this back and forth. I'm just looking through my own notes here to see how this worked, because honestly, I don't remember exactly. But, they had offered him to be a katzin. Now they're forced in Pasuk Chet to ask him to be in Pasuk Chet they're forced to ask him to be a Rosh, not only a Katzin, and Yiftach responds in Pasuk Tet, and Abarbanel and Malbim explained his response to be basically, of course I'm going to be the Rosh if I win, that's a given. And so what they say is, we will make you the Rosh already from now. So Yiftach takes over, and he launches a diplomatic initiative with Amon. He sends them this long letter, which we started on last time, and we thought that it was really interesting that Yiftach was trying diplomacy. It's not what I would have expected, certainly. And you can break Yiftach's argument down into essentially four parts. So the first part is in Perek Yud Aleph, Pasuk Yud Dalet. Trying to juggle the sheets here. Everyone has that? Perek Yud Aleph, Pasuk Yud Dalet, chapter 11, sentence 14. Everyone's muted themselves, so I'm taking that as a sign that they do have it. So, the first argument that Yiftach brings is to say to the people, to say to Amon, we didn't take the land from you, we took the land from Sichon, and it was only, frankly, because they forced it. So, a couple of notes on this opening approach of Yiftach. Take a look at Pasuk Ted Vav, sentence 15. Vayomer lo, he said to him, and him is, the king of Amon, Ko amar Yiftach, so says Yiftach. And then he launches into his statement that we didn't take the land of Moab, we didn't take the land of Amon, we came out of Mitzrayim, we went through the Midbar, and so on. But what strikes you already in Pasuk Yud Dalet? What's interesting there? Yeah. Oh, you know what's interesting? Hang on one second. I've been using headphones, but I just realized that what you say won't show up on the recording. So, okay, try again. So it's showing leadership by putting his name on the line. That's one way you could look at it. How else could you look at it? What else does this say to you when you say Ko Amar Yiftach?
He's got a great sense of his self-importance.
Doesn't he though? Right? I would have taken it the way that Michael does. Right? I'm hearing that from David as well. This is somebody who thinks his name means something. Otherwise, Ko Amar Yiftach, you could see them saying, well, who exactly? So if you take a look at the sheets, I brought you Al-Bag, who highlights this in source number one. He says, V'yidme sheshalach lo b'rashay hadvarim hashniyim Ko Amar Yiftach. He says, it appears that he sends to him at the start of the second message, so declares Yiftach. Ki ula Yiftach haya mefursam b'nehem b'gvura. Maybe because Yiftach was known as somebody mighty among them. Ras mepnei zeh lahodiyahu ki hu ha-moshel al Yisrael. Saying, I am in charge now. Kedei sheyishamer melech b'nei amam yilelachem Yisrael. You don't want to mess with me. I'm Yiftach. So that's the. It's a very interesting way for him to open up. However, he throws something odd into this, and it's something that we're going to have to come back to. But I want to highlight it already now, and that is, who exactly is he addressing in Pasuk Tedvav? I mean, he's addressing the king of Ammon. But what added element is here? Moab, right?
The Moabites.
The Moabites. What does Moab have to do with anything here? Right? We're throwing in Moab. Now, the truth of the matter is, Radak notes that in the portion that we did the last time we met, when Ammon described their land, they included lands that we identify as Moab's land as well. So much so that Professor Elitzur in the Dan Mikra edition suggests that there was some kind of a brother pact between Ammon and Moab. Which isn't so strange, because Moab has done that before. Who else do we know in Tanakh that Ammon has a brother pact of sorts with? Not really brothers in that case. They have a pact with Midian. Right? When the Jews initially come through, and Moab is afraid that the Jews are going to invade and take their land, so Balak...
Story with Balak.
Right. Balak Melech Moab makes some kind of pact with Midian. They work together to bring in Bilam and to attack the Jews. So here we find a pact between Ammon and Moab potentially, but I want to come back to the role of Moab in this. It's gonna keep on showing up in our psukim. So he says to them, going back to the text, he says, Israel did not take the land of Moab and the land of Ammon. Ki ba'alo sami Mitzrayim, when they came up out of Egypt, vayelech Yisrael bamidbar ad Yamsuf vayavo Kadesha. They went to the Yamsuf, and then they came to Kadesh. Why are we mentioning the Yamsuf at all? So Rashi says, because it marks the southern boundary of the land of Edom. However, Radak notes here something really, really important, which people often miss, and since we're coming up to Pesach, it's a good time to note it. Did you notice that it says they went ad Yamsuf? Right? We usually assume they went through the Yamsuf, not ad the Yamsuf. Sorry?
Is it Derech or...?
No, it says Ad Yamsuf, up to the Yamsuf. So Radak notes it. It's actually, Tosfos has this in, there's a picture of this in a Tosfos, where he points out the idea that we never crossed the Yamsuf. The account that we have in the Torah is actually an account of us making a semicircle. We enter the Yamsuf, we go on an arc. You must have heard this at some point before. We go on an arc through the sea, and then we come back on the same side.
Same side.
Correct. We come back on the same side as we entered. And what we benefited is just that we lose the Egyptians along the way. But that's supported here by the text that says that we went ad Yamsuf. So when you discuss Yamsuf either at your Seder, if you talk about it when you get to Dayenu, or in general through Pesach, you can point out that actually Shoftim Perek Yudalev supports this idea that we didn't actually come out on the other side at all. We came out on the same side. Continuing in this...
How is it supported in the Torah and the Pesukim? In other words, it's
right.
It's just a Midrash.
No. It is supported in the Pesukim. I'm not going to go through the whole thing now, I'll send out a link to the Tosfos, because it's a fascinating. It's a fascinating thing. It's certainly counterintuitive. It's not the way we understand the story when we start learning it. That's for sure. So he says. He says to them, "Vayishlach Yisrael malachim al melech Edom." we actually sent messengers to the king of Edom. Abarbanel picks up on that if you look at your sheet, source number 2. And he says, Yomar Sheyisrael Kasher Alami Mitzrayim Ubad Kadesh Miyad Shalach Malachim HaMelech Edom. We immediately sent messengers to the king of Edom and to the king of Moab. Granted that the Moab messengers show up only in Sefer Devarim, not in Sefer Bamidbar. But we sent messengers, and the point is, we weren't looking for a fight. We were not looking for war with these people. We said, Eberonah v'artzecha, I want to pass through your land. But the king of Edom did not listen, and the king of Moab did not listen, and so we sat in Kadesh, because we were told that we weren't supposed to fight with them. Right? That's the way that worked, is that we weren't supposed to fight. So we ended up in Pasuk Yuches, Vayasav el Eretz Edom, we went around Edom, that's Eretz Moab, we went around Moab, and instead we went all the way up to Eber Arnon, crossing the Arnon. We did not enter Moab, we did not attack them. Pasuk Yuches, we sent messengers to Sihon, who is king of the Amori. And we said to him, Nabranavi Artsakha ad Mekomi, we want to go through your land until we get to our place. Velohemin Sihon is Yisrael Abor Biglulo. And Sihon wouldn't let us go through his land. And Sihon gathers his nation, and we ended up in a war. That was in Pasuk Chaf. We didn't want their land, we weren't looking for trouble, and Sihon actually gathered for war, and that's how we ended up getting this land. It wasn't our decision. So that's his first argument. Clear? We're good? One of the things that I noted regarding this, regarding giving a Zoom shiur, when I did the Yeshaya one earlier today, is that I end up doing a lot more talking because people don't want to talk as much. But I don't think that's the best way to learn. So I hope people will still speak up.
Am I muted?
You are, yes.
Okay. So is this what you described at the end of the last shiur? That what was it? Something tohar v'sichon?
Yes. Precisely.
Amon's land.
Amon Umoab Tieru B'Sichon. Right. Sichon had captured land of Amon Umoab. We got it off of Sichon. We weren't taking anything from from Amon and Moab directly. Correct.
Is this a bit of a tana, like Gonev Migalav Batur? Like, we didn't steal it from you, we stole it from those who stole it from you?
Well, it's not so much a statement of Gonev Min HaGanav, because you're not allowed to steal. We're saying, number one, what we did was to get it from Sichon, because they wouldn't let us through. So what we did was legit. But number two, you don't have any claim against us, because we didn't even fight you for it. You lost the land earlier. Yeah, it's not our problem. And that actually is the idea leading to his second argument. Because his second argument, starting in Pasuk Chaf Gimel, is to say, think about it. You lost the land to Sichon. We came along and beat Sichon. So, are you thinking that you're going to profit by the fact that we beat Sichon? Right? Does that make any sense? Why is that our problem? Why should you benefit from the fact that God defeated Sichon? And so take a look at...
The end of that passage with Yosefa Arzahi, is that just to re-emphasize the fact that it belonged to Amori?
Yeah, I think so. I think he's taking every opportunity to underscore the fact that this had nothing to do with Amon and Moab. As a matter of fact, Howie, you use the dot mikra, don't you?
I do.
So take a look. He has the comment on it on Yoshev Aretz Ha'hi. Lo midei Amon Moab kavashnu es Aretz Ha'hi ki emidei ha'amori. Right? We didn't take it from Amon and Moab. We took it from the Amori. What do you want from us? You see that?
I see it.
Yeah. So Pasuk Chav Gimel, Pasuk Chav Dalet, he gives you his second argument. He says, and now, Hashem Elokei Yisrael Harishes El Amori Mipnei Amo Yisrael. Hashem conquered the Amori from before Israel. Ve'atati Rashenu. You should get it. And then he has this great sarcastic line. Halo Esa Shor Yerishcha Kamosh Elohecha Ososi Rash. You get what Kamosh gives you. Kamosh, your God, gives you something? Great. Enjoy. But Ve'ez Kol Asher Harish Hashem Elokeinu Mipaneinu Ososi Rash. What Hashem conquers? That's ours. So What's really interesting to me here, well, a couple of things. First of all, let's look overall at mentioning a god, throwing this in here. It happens from time to time in Tanakh that you get references to foreign gods. I happen to be almost up to it in Yeshaya, where Rav Shakeh, the agent of Sancheriv of Ashur, comes to the Jews and says, look at all these gods and how they weren't able to defeat Assyria. How do you think your god is going to be any different? So yeah, here it's along the same lines. It's sort of accentuating the powerlessness of this god Chemosh. But there are two different approaches here in the Mefarshim. If you take a look on the sheet at sources 3 and 4, Radak says this is an entirely serious argument. Ralbag, on the other hand, says that this is mockery. Before we read the actual sources, there's only one other thing you have to note. I think I may have mentioned it last time, which is that Chemosh is not the god of Ammon. Chemosh is the god of Moab. Ammon has a god, his name is Malcolm, but Chemosh is the god of Moab. So one way to look at this is that this is sort of evidence number two that Moab is a player in this, even though Ammon is the one who we're identifying as the leader. That's one way you could look at it. But we're going to see other ways to look at it. So take a look at Radak in number three. He says, Ata shoel ha'aretz shehimi Moav. You're asking for land which is really Moabite land. Umelach Amori lekachami Moav, velo isilo Chemosh Elohav. The king of the Amori got it from Moav. Chemosh, god of Moav, wasn't able to save it. And so he quotes you the pasuk from Bamidbar, Oylecha Moav, avadata am Chemosh, right? Woe is you, Moav, you are lost, nation of Chemosh. The inkein hu sha'aretz ha'isalacho, Chemosh haya Elohecha. And if it's true that the land was yours, and if you really are followers of Chemosh, then Esa Shayarishma, Chemosh Elohecha, so see Rosh, so go take whatever Chemosh your God gives you. If you choose to follow him, so gizantahe, have fun, take whatever he gives you. Kihu loa yachola tzil eretz ha'aretz miyad melech ha'amori, couldn't save it from the Amori. And Hashem gave that land to us. So Radak reads the line seriously, and he says, you claim the land was yours, it really belongs to Moab, Chemosh was the god of there. If you want to claim that land, and you are believers in Chemosh, who is supposed to be the god of that land, then take whatever Chemosh gives you. Radak reads it as a serious line. Ralbag, on the other hand, sees it as mockery. In number four, he says, "Va'amar lo asad halag." He said sarcastically, making fun of him. Halo esa shayirishta Chemosh alohecha sosi rosh. Whatever Chemosh your god gives you. Fine. Ki lo yachol Chemosh Eloheihem lahatzilah miyad Sichon, because Chemosh couldn't save them from Sichon. He couldn't save Moab from Sichon, and if you choose to follow him, he isn't going to save you either. That's the way that he reads it. Both of them are acknowledging that Chemosh isn't the god of Ammon, and they try to find ways to make it work within the text. They try to find ways to harmonize what's going on here by saying maybe you want to adopt Chemosh, you're claiming his land after all. Professor Yechezkel Kaufman offers another suggestion, which is that maybe Yiftach was being diplomatic by not mentioning Malcolm, but mentioning Chemosh instead. It's less in your face. He's not overtly claiming your god is weak. He's mentioning Chemosh instead. You follow?
Yeah.
You could read it that way. You could read it that way too. But again, we're going to see Moav in and out of this whole thing. This is, this is our second time that we're seeing Moav as a player. But I think we may need to discuss him a little bit further.
Sorry, just to go back to that Toharu, the sequence was it first? Ammon, Moab took it from Ammon?
No, Ammon and Moab are not at war with each other. Ammon and Moab are separate societies.
Right.
Amori conquered both of them.
Mm-hmm.
And we conquered the Amori.
Okay.
Yeah.
Isn't this whole discussion sort of Avodah Zarah? where he's acknowledging other gods and just saying our God is greater than their God?
So, I wouldn't call it Avodah Zarah. It's the only question is he serious or not, right? You have Ralbag's take, which is that... That's all right. You have Ralbag's take, which is that he's making fun of him and saying, you know, Kamosh is useless. He was useless for Moav, and he's useless for you too. And you have Radak, who's saying, look, if you believe in him, then take this up with him. In neither case is he adopting the narrative of Kamosh is a real god. He's just saying, you know, you seem to have some kind of an affinity for him. You know, try your luck with Kamosh if you want, but it doesn't bother us. You know, we are, at the end of the day, you can't benefit from our God's defeat of Sichon. That's the way that I read it. It is interesting, and that's why I pointed it out, that this is one of those cases where our side refers to a God of some other nation. You could also suggest, if you had to, Yiftach has been living out in the boondocks in Eretz Tov for a long time. You know, it's possible to make the argument that this was part of the culture there, but I don't think you even need to go there for that. Someone's phone is buzzing. I don't know if they want to just silence their mic.
I'll just put it away. I don't know how to...
Well, you can just mute your mic. That's all right.
I'm sorry?
If you just mute your mic, then it won't be an issue. Whenever that buzzes.
Mute my mic. My apologies.
No problem. Not an issue. Okay. So, to answer Howie's question, I don't think he's adopting it. I don't think he's acknowledging it as valid. I think he's simply saying, you know, our God did this. You know, you're welcome to try to work with their God and see how far it gets you. Then you get his third argument, and that's in Pasuk Chaf Hey. He says, "Ve'ata, and now, Hatov Tov Atami Balak Ben Sipor Melech Moav. Are you any better than Balak Ben Sipor, king of Moav? Harov Ravim Yisrael and Nochom Nilcham Bam." And this is a very interesting line, because you could read this line in a couple of different ways. Well, let me ask you, how would you read that sentence? How would you translate that sentence? I can see two different ways.
Are you more righteous than Balak Melech Zippor? Do you have more of a right to the land?
Okay, if you want, but I'm actually focusing on the latter part. Harov Ravim Yisrael and Nochom Nilcham Bam. You have translations. I don't know who's using what translation at this point. David, what do you have in your translation, and which edition is it?
I just have Sepharia in front of me.
Okay, so they're using JPS. Do you have...
Look at their translation.
See what they have there.
Yeah.
For the second half of the sentence.
Yeah, here we go. Did he start a quarrel with Israel or go to war with them?
Right, so that's one way to take it. In other words, what he's saying is, are you any better than Balak, who didn't fight with us? He didn't go to war with us, right? And lest you say, but he brought in Bilam. Look on the sheet at source number 5. Radak says, "Hamilchama yisash shalach Bilam lekalel osam." His war was that he sent Bilam to curse the Jews. V'hineh lo nilchamim Yisrael bavur arto. But he didn't actually fight for his land. Are you better than Balak, who didn't think that he could fight us? You want to take your chances? That's one way to read it. The other way that you could read it, I don't know if any of you have translations that do it this way, would be, are you greater than Balak, who fought with us? Harov Ravim Yisrael, who fought with us, who waged war against us. But that's not the way Radak reads it. Radak reads it as, are you greater than he, who didn't fight with us? He did not. He didn't make that push against us.
Sorry, what was the second way?
The second way would be: are you greater than Balak Melech Moav, who fought with Israel, who waged war against them? I'm inclined to the first read, which, as I said, is Radak's read.
Yeah, because in truth, they never did fight.
Correct. I mean, it depends on how whether you read that as fighting or not.
Military, right? Okay.
Right. And then Yiftach goes into his last argument in Pesukim Chavav and Chavzayin, where he says, Israel's been living in all of these different cities and their suburbs. Shlosh Mayos Shana for 300 years. Madolo Hitzaltem Ba'isahi, where have you been all this time? Right? I haven't done anything to you. Why exactly are you starting with us now? The 300 years is very interesting. Rashi gives you a medrash from Seder Olam Rabbah, Yud Beis, who tries to come up with how you get to the 300 years. Ralbag, Abarbanel, they all have a really good time trying to make this work, the whole 300 year thing. This number becomes really important when we get to a discussion at the end of Sefer Shoftim about the story of Shimshon, and then those stories at the end and when they happened. Ralbag and Abarbanel spend a lot of time trying to make this math work. The bottom line is, though, he says, whether he's being specific or he's giving a round number, he says, it's been 300 years, where have you been? To which Amon, in Pasuk Chavches, is completely unimpressed. V'lo shama melech b'nei Amon el divrei Yiftach asher shalach elav. I'm not really interested. Abarbanel picks up on something interesting here. The fact that Yiftach's name is part of this. It says that melech b'nei Amon did not listen to the words of Yiftach. So Abarbanel says it wasn't just a matter of they didn't agree with what he was saying. It's also a statement of Yiftach is an illegitimate ruler and he's an unworthy person with whom to communicate. We're not having any conversations with Yiftach. Okay? That concludes the diplomacy portion of this.
Is there an assumption that all the goyim, I mean, we have the Torah, but is there an assumption that all the goyim had their histories as well?
Yeah.
That he would know?
Absolutely. And we know that they did, because otherwise, why would Amon have come to us? Right? If we really are sitting here 300 years after the original conquest, and living in this land, and Amon is saying, "Hey, you took this land." Someone's got a historical record that that isn't named Israel.
Right, but most of the Yiftach's talk was about Balak or about other things, and not Amon at all.
Right.
So we have historical record of all the other nations that were there before Israel for 300 years.
It sounds like it from the way the story is told. And not only that, but it sounds like it's not even a point of disagreement. In other words, Amon is not rejecting, challenging this account of what the history was. It's a given that everybody's on board with that. You know?
Okay.
It seems like it.
Okay.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask two things. One is, just chronologically, you say the different Mefarshim grapple with the length of time.
Yeah.
Is it approximately 300? Like, is it all in the ballpark of other Chishuvim that are made? So that's one question. And second, could you just briefly review the four, just the titles of the four arguments?
Sure. So in terms of your first question, the commentators really try to take it as a hard number and not an approximate number. So I'll give you the count from Seder Olam that Rashi brings. He says Yehoshua is 28 years. Otniel is 40 years. Ehud is 80 years. Devorah is 40. This is all going to add up to 300. You don't need to do the math. I did it for you. Midyan is 7. Then Gidon is 40, meaning Gidon's 40 years follow the 7 years of subjugation to Midyan. 3 years of Avimelech. 23 years of Tola. 22 years of Yair. 1 year of Tola overlapping with Yair. And then 18 of Amon. That's how you get to the 300. So it's interesting because doing the calculation that way, that means Devorah's 40 includes the time when we're living under Canaan, But on the other hand, Gidon's 40 does not include the 7 years we're living under Midyan. But they get a precise 400. Well, if you really want to torture yourself, I can offer you, Ralbag, and I actually have two different versions of Ralbag's count. One is the Ralbag that's on the Bar Ilan CD-ROM, but there's also one that's found on the Da'at website. And if you wanted to, I could send you the link for it, which is better than the one that's on the Bar Ilan edition, but it still seems mathematically odd. Okay. Something seems wrong.
So we are approximately 300 years since...
One way or another.
343 since Yitzhak Mitzrayim.
Well, not since Yitzhak Mitzrayim, since we took the land. Right?
It's been 340,
I'm saying. It'll be 340 from... Yes, that's correct.
Yeah, around there. Okay.
Correct. That's what Ralbag's main problem is, because that means you only have 140 years or so until you get to, David and the Beis HaMikdash, Shlomo and the Beis HaMikdash. And that has to include all the remaining Shoftim, Eli, Shmuel, Shaul, David, and then the beginning of Shlomo. Like, it's a lot of things that have to happen in this remaining 140 years.
140, so that whole Cheshbon is what about the 140, just to have a general overview?
Oh, no, because the Torah actually tells us how many years elapsed from the time we leave Egypt until the construction of the first Beis HaMikdash. In Malachim Aleph, Perek Ches, Perek Zayin, somewhere there, you have the pasuk that tells you it's been 400, and I always forget, 480 or 490, but I think it's 490.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
The other thing was you wanted to know the four headings to this. So the first argument was we took it from Sichon, not you. Second argument was you can't benefit from our God's defeat of Sichon. Third argument is the argument of Balak didn't fight us. He knew he wasn't going to win. You should know better than to try. And then the fourth argument is we've been living here for centuries. Leave us alone.
Thank you.
Okay. So now we're up for the infamous vow. Three psukim here. Pasuk Chavtet, Pasuk Lamed, Pasuk Lamed Aleph. V'atihi al yiftach ruach Hashem. The Spirit of God is upon Yiftach. Magic language. The Spirit of God is upon Yiftach. That's language that we use to refer to God selecting a shofet. It's Ruach HaKodesh. This is Yiftach, I think, coming into his own. Vayavoras haGilad ve'as Menashe, vayavoras mitzpeh Gilad, mimitzpeh Gilad avar b'nei Amon. He rallies troops. He crosses through Gilad, through Menashe, mitzpeh Gilad, to the land of Amon. And then he makes the vow. Pasuk Lamed. Vayidar yiftach neder l'Hashem vayomar. He made a neder. He swore, im nason titenes b'nei Amon b'yadi. If you will give Amon into my hands, v'haya hayotze, the one who emerges, Asher Yetzei Midal Seve Silik Rasi, who comes out of the doors of my house to greet me, B'shuvi V'shalom Mibnei Amon, when I come back in peace from Amon, V'hayal Hashem V'ha'alisihu Olah. It will be for God, and I will bring it up, he says, as an Olah, a burnt offering. Oh boy. So, ask the questions that you have to ask here.
What? Once he says it's coming out of his house, then we're talking about a person problem.
Ostensibly, right? What do you keep in your house? what did he think was going to happen? Isn't that bizarre?
Yeah.
What else?
Why did he make it anyways? God did not ask anything of him.
Yeah, why is he volunteering vows in the first place? Why did he think this was a good idea? What did he think was going to happen? The whole thing is catastrophically bizarre. So let's look at this neder, right? The idea of taking a vow. In general, how does the Torah look at vows?
It wants us to... The Torah wants us to refrain from them.
Right. You have the pasuk. I gave you references in source number 6 there to Psukim in Tanakh. Right? One in Sefer Devarim, V'chi sechdal lindor lo yevachachet. When you don't vow, you won't have a sin. The one in Koheles, Tov Asher Lo Tidor. Better not to take vows. Let's add to that. We have a troubled history of vows. Right? You remember the story with Yericho? Yoshua takes a vow. Nobody should take from the spoils. Take a look at source number 7, please. Rashi comments there on that story involving the taking from the spoils. It's Bishvilcha Zos Lahem. You want to know why you're in trouble? God blames Yoshua. This is your fault. Lo amarti lecha lagdish shalal ha'ir. I didn't tell you that you should consecrate the spoils. That was your decision. All right. I'll give you another example in source number 8. What story is that that I'm referencing for you in number 8? Shmuel Aleph Perek Yadalid. That's the story in which the Jews are fighting a war against the Plishtim. Shaul sees that we have the advantage, and he declares an oath that nobody shall eat that day. He doesn't want them getting distracted with the spoils. Nobody shall eat that day. His son Yehonatan is unaware, right? Doesn't know about this oath. He ends up eating, and that becomes a potential catastrophe. He's spared from it when the nation says he should not kill his son. But you look at this and say to yourself, like, you know, we don't, I mean, this our story is before Shaul. You can't blame him for not learning from Shaul. You could blame him for not learning from Yehoshua. Yeah, you could blame him for not knowing we're not supposed to take vows. However, don't kid yourself, because the Torah does have vows, right? We have mitzvos of nedarim, right? We have the special case of the nazir. Sometimes vows have a positive result to them, right? Yaakov takes a vow of what he's going to give to, what he's going to give to Hashem. And I gave you a reference here in source number 9. I gave you the reference to Yaakov and his vow, but also in Bamidbar Perek Chaf Aleph, the Jews are going to go to war against the Canaanite, and they take a vow to give all the spoils to God, and that works out well. So the truth of the matter is that you can't deny that even though we have a bad history with vows, and even though in general we don't like them, they do have a place within the Torah. When I taught Shoftim to the women's shir, there was a woman there who noted that, something that I think is really a good summary of the issue. There's a natural instinct to bargain with God. You know, to offer God something extra, something above and beyond what God has demanded from us. And so the Torah legislates it. Since, psychologically, we have an inclination to offer God things, the Torah tells us, okay, if you're going to offer God things, here's how you shall do so. This is the way that it's going to work. And I think that's what's going on here. There's a natural inclination to want to offer God something, and I brought you a Tosfos in Chulin, who notes that you can do this, you may do this in a time of Sara, in a time of trouble. If you take a look at source number 10, Tosfos there talks about the issue of vows and our, in that context, negative way to look at vows. And he says, Vim Torah, you might ask, Vaksiv Vayidar Yaakov Neder, I mentioned to you, Yaakov takes a vow, and it's okay. And also in Yonah, Esa Shenadarti Ashalema, Yonah, when he's in the fish, says, I will fulfill that which I have vowed. The answer could be, at a time of trouble, this is actually permitted. And he quotes you a Medrash in Bereishis Rabbah that comments on Yaakov's vow. It says, Vayidar Yaakov neder lemor. He took a vow, lemor, to say. To say to whom? Lemor ledaros shiyu nodrim be'eis tzara. To teach that there is such a thing as taking a vow in a time of need, that a person would in fact be able to do so, and that's what Yaakov did. You know, if you think about Hannah in the beginning of Sefer Shmuel, vowing that if she has a child, she's going to dedicate him to Hashem. Also, same variety of neder, and presumably Yiftach is going to say, that's what I'm doing. I am taking such a vow. The only difference...
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
No, go ahead. doesn't Abraham also take a vow?
That wasn't a vow. That was a negotiation.
Was it a shua or something? I can't remember.
I will not take. Oh, because he says Harimosi Adi El Hashem.
Yeah.
Right.
It was more of a shua.
Well, if anything, it's a negative shua. It's I am not going to take.
Yeah.
Not I am going to do something extra. And he's not addressing God. He's trying to tell the king of Sodom, leave me alone, I'm not taking this. You know, I think it's a different sort of... that's all right. But Yiftach makes his vow in a terribly wrong way. And this takes me back to what I said when I introduced this section of Shoftim. You know, the general theme of Amon, of trying to do something good, but doing it in a warped way, which we saw with his brothers who want to exclude him. He's the son of the Zonah and all that, and they kick him out. So we see it also with Yiftach. He wants to do something that I think fundamentally he wants to do the right thing. I think that that's what he's trying to do. But, you know, boy, what a disaster he ends up creating. But let's look at this. Let's look closer at what he promised. Pasuk Lamed Aleph. How many promises did he actually make here? This is going to matter when we actually see what happens to his daughter. How many promises did he make?
Maybe two. Is it separate from Valiti Ola?
Exactly the right question to ask. That's exactly the right question to ask. Right? I would take a poll if we were doing this in person and people could raise their hand, but I see a whole bunch of muted mics, and it's probably better that way for this purpose. But you have to ask yourself, do I read this as whatever comes out of my house will be for God as a burnt offering, or it will be for God and I will bring it up as a burnt offering? So two different ways to read this. The classic view, and the one that we usually assume when we read it, is that no, he's pledging whatever comes out of my house is going to be a karban. It's one vow. That's it. Whatever comes out of my house is going to be a karban. And frankly, that's the Gemara in Tanis, right? Take a look, please, at source number 11. Shlosha shalu shaloka hogen. Three people asked for things inappropriately, and we jump immediately to Yiftach. We're not going through the other ones. The other two get away with it. Yiftach does not get away with it. And there's a fourth in some versions of this in the Medrash, but it's not important for us for right now. Yiftach ha-giladi dechsiv, v'haya ha-yotzei asher yetzei midalsei beisi, etc. Whoever emerges from my house, yochal avilu davar tamei, the Gemara says. What if it was a pig that came out of his house? Then what? Heshivo shaloka hogan, and therefore he was answered inappropriately. Nizdamna lobito. It was his daughter who came out. Behind the Kamar Lahuli Nabili Yisrael, as the prophet Yirmiyahu says to the Jews, Hatsari ein begilad imro fe ein sham. Is there nothing we can do in Gilad? Right? He's Yiftach in Gilad. Is there nothing we can do in Gilad to repair things? Uchsiv. Another pasuk, Yirmiyahu, about people who bring inappropriate karbanos, asher lo tivisi, velo dibarti, velo alsa alivi. Karbanos I never commanded, I never said, never entered my heart. What does that refer to? Asher lo tivisi is the son of Mesha, king of Moab. That's its own story. God willing, one day we get to Malachim Beis, and we can learn that story. But Mesha, Mesha, king of Moab, tries to bring his son as a carbon to God, and lo dibarti, that I never stated, is Yiftach, and lo al salibi, it never entered my heart, is Yitzchak, son of Avram. Hashem didn't want anybody killed. Hashem does not like human sacrifice, says the Gemara. But the read here in this Gemara is that Yiftach is promising a carbon. I brought you in number 12, the Psukim with Mesha, king of Moab, just that you could see that story. But it's not so relevant for our discussion, really. I just brought it there so that you would see Mesha's case of child sacrifice, because it's unfamiliar to people. But that's one way. However...
So Mesha actually did it? He did offer?
Yep. Yes.
Wow.
Wow, indeed. But many mefarshim, many commentaries read this as a more flexible commitment, which could be fulfilled without killing. So Radak is an example of that. He says, actually, the way to read those words at the end of the pasuk is v'hayal Hashem, it will be for God, v'halitihu olah, or I will bring it as a burnt sacrifice. Not and, but or. And along the lines of Radak, you find Abarbanel, you find Malbim. They go that route. Take a look, please, at source number 13. Da'at Razal Bazei Yadua. The position of our sages on this is known, meaning the Gemara, that it was actually meant to be a karpan. But then he continues. Va'adoni avi zal pireish. He says, my father explained, v'ha'alitiu havav b'makom o. V'ha'alitiu doesn't mean and I will bring it, but rather or I will bring it. U'pireish, and he explained, v'haya hashet l'ashem hekdesh im eino ro'oi la'ola. It will be dedicated, sacred to God if it's not suitable as an ola. Or, oh, halisiu alaim, roi la la, bring it as an ola if it's suitable for that. Kach nira lefi pashtei hapsukim. He says, that's the simple read. V'divrei razal, and as far as the words of our sages, in kabbalah hi biyadam aleinu lekabbalah. Well, if they have a tradition, then we have to accept it. But he says, I think the straight read in the psukim is not a dedication of a korban. That's Radak's read. Ralbag has another way to read it, also within this school of thought that says he's not promising a karban. He says all it meant was service of God. He emphasizes the hayal Hashem, that it's going to be for God. Take a look at number 14. He says, v'hine, hayotzei midalsei beiso yeh bechreach bal hachayim. He says, whatever's going to come out of his house, it's got to be a living thing. Right? I mean, that's a given. If it's a person, it will be for God, dedicated for the service of Hashem and only the service of Hashem. How does that play out? If it's a man, it doesn't mean that he's now going to have to be a monk, separated from women, he can't get married. He'll be like a Kohen or a Levi. He'll serve Hashem in the Mishkan. You have a model for serving God that doesn't involve celibacy. So says Rabag. However, if it's a woman, she's going to have to separate from men. Because if she marries, then she can't only serve God. He says, don't shoot the messenger. He says, she's also going to have to serve her husband. So what Ralbag is setting up for you, which I caution you about how you use this line, but Ralbag makes the statement that, well, what he's really doing is, I'm assuming people here are roughly familiar with where this story goes in the end. There is a school of thought that Yiftach's daughter ends up never marrying, but living out her days single. So Ralbag says that this is actually logical. He says, had it been a man, so it would have been dedicated to work in the Mishkan. We didn't have service for women in the Mishkan. Therefore, she ends up needing to be single. That's the way that Ralbag reads this. That's how they will be dedicated to God and not to anybody else. I don't really know what to do about this whole business about being dedicated to the husband. We do find an issue of kavod for a husband. That is true. On the other hand, a husband has all sorts of obligations to his wife. So I'm not really so clear as to what Ralbag is accomplishing, other than attempting to harmonize the story.
Are we saying divorce was not dedicated to God?
I'm not going to really be able to answer for Ralbag.
Okay.
It's a good question. I mean, I really believe that Rav Bank's comment is a case of drawing the bullseye, and that, you know, after you've already shot the arrow, meaning he's reading the end of this story as she is single, and then trying to figure out how the psukim can take you there. That's the way it looks to me. Is that's how he's doing it, and he's just adding this business of, and if we're a man, it wouldn't have to be so, but because it's a woman, it has to be so. But honestly, you don't even need that in order to get there. I'm not so clear on that.
And does anyone have a payment explanation where it's two separate promises?
Oh yeah, no. That was the approach that we just saw before, right? That was the approach of Radak of Abarbanel Malbim, is that it's two different things. It's either serving God or sacrifice. If it's suitable to be a karban, it'll be a karban. If it's suitable to serve God, then it'll serve God. For that matter, you can read Ralbag that way as well. Right? Ralbag also is saying either it's going to be a karban or it's going to serve God. What Ralbag is doing that's different is saying that serving God means celibacy.
Right, but no one's saying that it's both. Assuming it's a person coming out, that the person will go to God, plus he will give an olah, like two separate...
Oh, that it's an and? No, I haven't seen anyone... I have not seen anybody read it as an and. No.
Okay, because that's what I thought
David
said initially, but okay.
Yeah. So...
I was always wondering when I read this story, why didn't he just do a father-in-law?
And we're going to get there. Not this week, but that is decidedly coming up. We have to have... It's an unbelievable array of comments on how in the world this thing went through. And Yiftach is a shofet. Like, you know, like how does this thing go through? It's bizarre. I wanted to show you two things on this before we finish up. First of all, Ramban in number 15. Ramban thinks that Ibn Ezra is in the camp with Radak, with Abarbanel, of those who think that that it's an either or type of a thing. And Ramban says, I can't believe Ibn Ezra thought this. Take a look at number 15, just reading my translation in the interest of time. And be not fooled by the emptiness of Rabbi Avram, who said that, quote, I will bring it as a burnt offering is, or I will bring it as a burnt offering. To say that if the one which emerges from the door of my home is a man or a woman, it will be sacred to God, separated from the ways of the world to serve in the name of God in prayer and thanks to God. And if it is suitable for sacrifice, I'll bring it up as a burnt offering. And he made for his daughter a home outside the city where she was alone. He supported her. No man knew her. His daughter was, quote, bound. Right? Aguna will be the term that we use. He says, this is mere wind. He says, this is absolutely empty. This is nonsense. Had he vowed for her to be for God, she would not be separated, celibate. She would be like Shmuel. He is sort of where Ralbag wanted to go with it. He says, she would have been like Shmuel, whose mother said, I'm going to give him to God. He served in God's house. He wasn't separated. Shmuel had kids. And per the laws of the Torah, one cannot vow that those who leave the door of his house will be separated. Just one can't bring them as a burnt offering. What right does he have to vow that his daughter is going to be celibate? That's not within his powers. God forbid to have a law in Israel to wail, this is from the end of the story, to wail for the daughter of Yiftach for 4 days each year because she didn't marry and she served God in purity. He says, what are you talking about? Rather, it is as its simple meaning. His error was, as I have said, that he actually tried to dedicate her as a karban. Ramban is firmly in line with the Gemara. He says, anything else is a misread. Flip the page to number 16 and look at Abarbanel. He says, the Midrashim explained that Yiftach made his daughter a burnt offering and it was an error, and that his daughter also erred in thinking that this was the law. But what I have written, according to the simple meaning, is the correct approach, reconciled with the simple meaning of the text. He says, absolutely not. As vociferous as Ramban is, that shot in the psukim is that she was supposed to be a karban, Abarbanel is adamant that the simple read is that she was not supposed to be a karban, that he was offering two different options. The Rabbi Tzalel Zev Safran in the Shut Rabbaz quotes his father as going with the view of Abarbanel, Radak, and so on, saying that Yiftach is a shofet. He can't possibly have murdered his daughter. It doesn't make any sense. see Avimelech and whether Avimelech was a shofet or not. But when we get to the end of this and the actual fulfillment of the vow, God willing, next week, we're going to see evidence that supports both sides, whether the approach that he actually killed her or the approach that that she was left to be celibate. So, God willing, next week, I presume it'll be by Zoom once again. It's at the same Zoom address. I set this up as a recurring meeting. We will continue with this and see how the story plays out. Okay?
Shkoyach for setting this up.
Shkoyach to everybody here. Thank you all for participating. I wish you a week of bryut.
Yes, you too and your family. Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right, be well.
Very well. Bye-bye.
Well done.